This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast Friday, September the 23rd. What have we been up to? Well, we've been having a look at those SALIC numbers, nearly 50 times oversubscribed. What does that mean for the day that the bell rings next week? We've been speaking to veteran investor Mohammed Ali Yassin. Also, having a look ahead of the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's visit to the UAE as to what could be on the agenda. Gas, gas and more gas. We've had the economist Christoph Ruhl of Columbia University in the studio with us this morning to put that visit and indeed the European energy crisis in a little bit more context for us. Bring it a little bit closer to home. And one of the big headlines of the week, UAE courts will now be enforcing UK courts' decisions, particularly when it comes to financial rulings. What does that mean for us here? Reza Mithani is a lawyer. He's from Kinsella's Law. He's been, well, putting it in context. A lot of numbers to go through this morning, whether or not they are interest rate numbers or whether a little bit closer to home, they are subscription numbers or oversubscription numbers.
This is the SALIC IPO, and clearly it's been a resounding success, hasn't it? They've raised $1 billion, 3.7 billion dirhams, but one of the most interesting aspects is how much money was bid for those shares. Almost a quarter of a trillion dirhams. I mean, not quite, 184 billion, but that is close to a quarter of a trillion. Those are big numbers. Those are huge numbers, and it shows you that the appetite is there. We've been speaking to one of the UAE's veteran stock market experts, haven't we?
We have indeed. Mohammed Ali Yassin is capital markets advisor and specialist in the markets here. We asked him what he made of those numbers.
Final numbers for the SALIC IPO have taken everyone by surprise. All stakeholders involved in this IPO must have been shocked by the final numbers, especially after an IPO of T-Com and the slow start of the SALIC IPO. I think the game changer in the SALIC IPO was when the government came and put a price of 2 dirhams early on, giving a strong signal that it really is looking for investors to participate in this company at a realistic valuation rather than building up a price on the higher end, which could result in a drop once being listed on the stock market on the DFM end of the month.
So what could that 49 times, as Richard says, nearly 50 times oversubscription rate mean for the price?
And I believe this will result in a pop-up in the price once listed on the DFM because the demand is way higher than the supply available. And I think you will see that how far could that be? Could it be 15, 20%? It is possible. The question is, how high will it go and how long can it sustain itself at that price? That's what's important. The issue here is that I think many of the investors will get very low allocation. Whether you are an institutional professional investor or whether you are a retail investor where you are pro rata, you're getting the allocation pro rata, the allocation is going to be extremely low. And therefore, people who are trying to participate to become rich out of this IPO, I think they will be disappointed. They will make the returns, but the number of shares is low.
Which has been the case with the retail portions of the IPO in general. I mean, I know, and I can't remember the exact numbers at the moment, but for putting down, I think, roughly 100,000 in Diwa and 120,000 in Baruj, I say put it down, the vast, vast majority of it comes back to you. I put the same money into both of those IPOs because you know, okay, it's my rent money if the landlords are not listening, but you know you're going to get it back in your bank account in 7 days or whatever the turnaround is. And I think I got somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 in both of those IPOs. That was the percentage allocation there.
One of the questions is, what's going to happen to the share price? because we know that with Diwa, the one you bought into, basically the share price is pretty much within a couple of fills where it was when you bought it. We know for TCOM, it's down about 10% right now. What's going to happen to this one? I mean, of course, we don't know. That was Thursday. The markets do what they do and they make their own mind up. But that's one of the things we're looking at, isn't it?
Are you asking Mohammed Ali Yassin what he expects to see on the first day of trading?
Why not?
I believe this is going to be a successful listing in DFM, and it's going to provide a positive push and momentum to the next IPO that may come as part of the Dubai government. I think the main message I can read and see and should be taken by all is that price those IPOs at a reasonable price. Don't put it at a high valuation, and you will get high participation from investors, and you will get an upward movement of the share price in the market. Some of their companies which are selling some of their shares, they are not selling all the companies. They're selling 15 to 20% or 25% like this case. Therefore, you still have 75% where you are benefiting from any price movement upwards in the market. And a lot of that price movement of valuation will come from the price movement in the market, and that is the sustainable one, rather than actually just do it on the short term. So I think this is a very strong message. It's a good approach, and it's a better approach for UAE markets, at least, when you go in and you have a fixed price initially, where you remove all uncertainty about valuation and kind of other issues, and you leave it the investors. You will find that the investors will participate heavily in those IPOs, provided they are getting reasonable allocations as part of the subscription.
That's Mohammed Ali Yassin.
Investments go up and investments go down. Before putting your hard-earned money into any investment, Dubai Eye 103.8 advises you to always do your own background research. Ensure you're informed to navigate the market and any potential pitfalls. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
And the big energy story this weekend in the UAE is German.
Ich will Immos, ich will Dallas, ich will fliegen wie bei Marvel. Ich hab Hunger, also nehm ich mir alles vom Buffet. Will ein Haus für meine Mama an der Küste von Catania. Zum Frühstück Cannabis und dein White Berry.
That is Wild Berry, currently the number one song in Germany on Spotify. Our next guest could happily translate it for us, but I'm not going to ask him to. He is Senior Research Scholar at the Centre on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, Christoph Ruhl. Good morning. Thanks to have you with us.
Good morning, Richard. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks very much indeed. So it is a big weekend for Germany here in the UAE, and that is because the German Chancellor is going to be joining us here in the UAE. He is Olaf Scholz. Of course, like all world leaders, he's been in New York earlier on this week for the United Nations General Assembly. Let's hear from him now. This is what he had to say at the opening of that event.
We know that we owe our freedom, our stability and our prosperity to an international order with the United Nations at its core. Therefore, my country's commitment to this organization and its noble goals, peace, development and equal rights and dignity for every human being, will never wane.
Olaf Scholz, we believe, is coming here mainly to secure gas supply deals from the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and of course Qatar as well. What's your reading of his visit, Christoph?
I think that's exactly right. He's on a weekend shopping tour. He's visiting those three countries, and clearly Germany needs to fill a huge gap which is left by Russian gas exports no longer coming, no longer wanted, and probably being cut off in the winter. Now, what he's going to buy here is probably not so much relevant for this winter, but it's also about the longer-term prospect of replacing Russian pipeline imports with LNG imports from anywhere, including from this region, which in turn is keen to increase their LNG production and exports.
Well, let's separate the short-term and the long-term. First of all, what are we now? 23rd of September, so winter is coming in Northern Europe. There's a lot of demand for heating in Northern European countries like Germany coming up in the next few weeks or so. I guess the good news is, I'm reading today on S&P Platts, that Germany has topped 90% in terms of gas storage, and it's making good progress in building terminals to receive LNG, liquefied natural gas, so-called FSRUs, or floating storage and regasification units. Where do we stand for the short term for this winter?
So indeed, as you said, the good news is that storage is fuller than usually at this time, both for Germany, 90%, and the EU also, 86.5%. The bad news is that even if it's at 100%, it's only lasting for about 2.5 months. And the winter in Germany and northern and central European countries is anywhere between 3.5 and 4.5 months. So that storage level alone just puts you at the mercy of the weather. New imports are needed. The other side of that coin is the Russian side. Russian exports to Europe, they used to account for more than 40% of European Union gas consumption, is now accounting only for 9%. Exports have gone down by almost 80%. You know, so Russia has lost a large part of this market and has lost it probably for good. And that, in my opinion, leads to the conclusion that Russia has not much to lose this winter, and they're very likely to cut off the gas if they see any political advantage for it. So that's the mixture, and that means that measures are needed in Europe and in Germany in particular to make sure when this cutoff comes and inventories are not enough alone, that replacements are there, that gas savings cut in, and that cutoffs eventually will not hurt the country.
Now, traditionally, and I've been in this region a long time, I'm not an expert on gas, but I've covered it a bit, building what's called a regasification unit, a terminal that can take ships of LNG from the UAE or Qatar, takes 2, 3, maybe 4 years. And yet Germany's trying to do it in just a few months. And the way they're doing it is with these FSRUs, these basically floating regasification units. Can they get the job done in the short term, Christoph?
The proposal was, or the idea is to build 5 of these terminals. They won't be able to finish all 5 of them in the winter, but they will be able to finish for sure 2 and probably 3 of them, floating terminals, as you said. And that will kick in after November or so. So that's also probably at the backside of winter. I think that they prepare for this very actively, have to face the prospect that gas is actually being cut and not enough, so that there is some rationing taking place. And this is now an interesting thing, because you have to ask yourself, why is gas so important? What does it do? And it does 3 things. It can be used to produce electricity, and there it can be substituted with coal and nuclear and wind and solar, so that can be substituted for. It can be used for space heating, as it's called. That's households and their apartments and houses being heated. That's the big political problem. And it can be used as feedstock for industry. And that's very important in Germany, because the chemical industry, which uses it, is the 3rd biggest industrial sector. And there, it cannot be replaced. So now you have a legislation and a political debate which is all focused on households needing to be protected. But everybody knows what really needs to be protected is the industrial feedstock, because you don't want to create a recession. And so people now, they used to have the corona numbers in the newspapers. Now right next to them are the gas storage numbers. And they try to figure out to what an extent households will have to be cut off and to what extent they can voluntarily save. And that's the key question here. Everybody knows it's households which are in the front line, and industry will be protected.
Really? So if it comes to a choice between, okay, Mercedes-Benz and BASF need the gas, or Herr und Frau Schmidt in Baden-Württemberg, then it's Siemens and Mercedes-Benz and BASF who are at the front of the queue?
Yes, because what they need is much, much smaller. It's just about 7% of the whole, which really is a core element of 20% go to industry versus 40% to households. And don't forget, you know, we have a situation where cutoffs are sort of only the last resort and only probably very small to occur. And if Herr and Frau Schmidt lose their job at BASF or Mercedes-Benz, you know, then a well-heated apartment is no use in the long term.
So let's talk about the long-term objectives that Chancellor Scholz has here on his visit. You said he's looking to secure not just gas for this winter, but he wants long-term alternatives to Russian gas. What are his strategic options?
So if more than 50% of Germany's gas consumption came from Russian pipelines, Germany has strategically made a decision and an announcement that they will replace all of that by 2024. That's a big amount of gas to come. However, Germany also has a very progressive energy policy in fostering renewable growth. And they have said they want to decarbonize and cut down on including gas consumption, fossil fuel consumption. And by 2045, I think, want to be completely carbon neutral. Now, the problem is that anyone who has to sell gas now, anyone who wants to sell LNG, including this region, of course, this price is very high, good for us. And what we want is a long-term contract at these prices, 20 years, 30 years. And if you want lower prices, then even longer, so that we have security that the gas will be bought when prices come down. Germany, with its energy policy going towards decarbonization, doesn't want to do that. So they want to have short-term contracts. There was a visit of the German energy minister in Qatar a few months ago where the negotiations just stalled at that point and no decision was made. Now they're trying it again, and this is where the compromise has to be found between the length of the contract and the price.
Looking forward to the visit this weekend of Olaf Scholz to the United Arab Emirates. We've talked about his short and long-term energy objectives. Can we take a step back and talk about what he's like? Because he's new in the job, massive shoes to fill following Angela Merkel's 15-year tenure as Chancellor. Reading about him, he started life very left-wing. He was a member of certain Communist Party affiliations. Now he's a bit more of a centrist. What do we know about Olaf Scholz?
One thing is they call him the Smurf because he's, you know, sort of has this sort of smile which doesn't reveal very much of what he thinks. If he
the
has
Smurf.
Economically, yeah, you know, the little blue figures.
I do.
With different characteristics. That's his nickname. There's many people. It's not meant badly, I think. But he won a election campaign where he was the leading candidate, probably because of there wasn't much competition. And so that's also where this comes from. And he won a lot of it by simply smiling in answer to questions like yours. But to give you an answer, he was not in a communist party. He was in a left-wing fraction of the Social Democrats, which is the sort of mainstream leftist party in Germany. If he has any philosophy on the economic side at all, he used to have one, which was pretty leftist, I think. And he would probably, like Merkel before him, despite them being in different parties, still err on the side of high taxes, a lot of government. You can see that, you know, when in first response to this gas crisis and the super high gas prices and the threat of a shortage, the idea of the government was to raise taxes on gas to use the money to bail out the companies. You know? Or when they are sort of debating windfall taxation and then distributing checks to everyone, regardless how high in the hierarchy is. So very much this kind of German corporatist mesh between industry and state, which need to be sort of all comforted. He's certainly not the man who is going to break up bureaucracy and change the system like Gerhard Schröder did. This is also important politically on another side, because he was very firmly on the side when he was young of the Social Democrats, who wanted not just detente with Eastern Germany and the Soviet Union at the time, but also close cooperation. So there's lots of articles about how, as a young aspiring young leftist politician, he would visit East Germany and go back and forth and make all sorts of statements he probably regrets today. But these days are over. So now he's just one of these mainstream politicians, I would say. Not very different from Angela Merkel, actually.
Finally, Christoph, let's ask about yourself, because you've had a longish career. You started off as an economist with energy companies and had some very, very senior roles there. And then you moved to Abu Dhabi because you spent a lot of time living here in the UAE, didn't you? You were head of global research with the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, one of the world's biggest sovereign wealth funds. I'd like to say how was it, but it's a very secretive organization, so you probably can't tell me.
I was an academic first, and then I moved to energy, and then that's correct. And I spent 5 years at this organization, and I'm not at liberty to tell you much, and there isn't really much to tell other than that I'm no longer there. You know, so let's just probably leave it there.
I think that's probably we'll all save our jobs if we leave it there. Let me ask your thoughts about the big interest rate debate that we're having. Brandy Scott, I'm going to bring my colleague Brandy in here. Morning, Brandy.
Morning.
You're calling it Central Bank Week because
yes.
Why?
They're all lining up to mostly raise interest rates.
But I am against this policy. I feel that it's fighting the wrong war. You can raise interest rates, you'll cause a recession. It's not going to bring down oil or food prices. It's just going to cause misery in America or Germany, where the European Central Bank is starting to do it, or the United Kingdom, which raised rates yesterday. But that's just my view. What's your view?
Well, Olaf Scholz probably would agree. My view is a bit more, there's no either or in this. I think I was among those who have been warning for a long time that inflation is going to come, and we're actually puzzled why we didn't have it earlier. And I think the Fed was asleep at the wheel and clearly missed the point at which they wanted to raise it. That's the first thing. The second is, if you have as they say, to cut the tail of a dog. You know, you better do it in one go, not, you know, successively. That's the second. But the third one is there is a tendency of those who come late to then overstay their welcome. And I see that there is what you're saying, that there is a tendency now by the Fed and so to go full throttle and to make this big point, which they have to make. They have to prove that they're serious to contain inflationary expectations and to then overdo it. Now, the good news is, you know, if a recession is just a terribly technical term, actually, it just means two quarters no or negative growth. And currently we have full employment everywhere. We still have strong growth everywhere. And you look out of the window, it doesn't feel like a recession, doesn't smell like a recession, doesn't look like misery everywhere. So if you have a recession right now and it comes with 3% unemployment, not with 15% unemployment, as some American economists said, you know, then I would take that such a recession any day, any day. So the hope is that we may get a recession, but it will be short and it will be shallow.
Last question. Lots of comments this week in New York from the heads of big regional oil companies. Abu Dhabi National Oil Company yesterday, Sultan Al Jaber, saying that the world is facing an energy crisis because of underinvestment in oil and gas infrastructure. We had the same from Amin Nasser a couple of days ago, the boss of Saudi Aramco. Again, Brandy and I disagree on this. You think it's what? Just oil CEO saying oil's great?
Well, I'm just saying they might have a vested interest in people using energy and oil and saying that there's not enough of it.
30 seconds. What's your take, Christoph?
I agree. There's an interest in that. They would say that. There's also a long-term problem, which most of us underestimated. We will need oil and gas to a much larger extent than people think. So what of all people, Elon Musk made the statement is if you want an energy transition, you need to produce more oil and gas to have the security of energy supplies on the back of which you can change everything.
Christoph, it's been great talking to you. Appreciate you joining us in the studio this morning. That's the voice of Christoph Ruhl. He's Senior Research Scholar, Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Danke schön.
You're welcome.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-sized Business Breakfast.
We are looking at one of the big news stories of the week. UAE courts now able to enforce financial rulings in UK cases. What does that mean for business? We are very pleased to be joined in the studio again, for the first time since the beginning of COVID, by Raza Mithani, Managing Partner at Consellus Law. Raza, it's lovely to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Lovely to be back. Thank you, Brandy.
So this has all come about because of a ruling by the Ministry of Justice here in the UAE. What can courts here actually now do in practice?
So first of all, in practice, what's happened is that the Ministry of Justice has issued a letter to the Director General of the Dubai Courts requesting the Dubai Courts to enforce English judgments on the basis of what's known as the principle of reciprocity, which basically means if you enforce my judgments, I will enforce your judgments.
So what's actually going to change?
So what this does is it makes the likelihood of enforcing an English judgment in the UAE, well, specifically in Dubai, much greater. Before, the largest impediment to enforcing these English judgments in the UAE was that there was no reciprocity. So the Dubai court simply said, there's no reciprocity, so we're not going to enforce an English judgment. Having said that, there have been some examples where English judgments have been enforced, but generally the Dubai courts have declined to enforce judgments on the basis of a lack of reciprocity.
And we're talking here about financial judgments. So what could happen in practice? What could happen on the ground?
So the on the ground, the sort of judgments you're talking about typically would be things like contractual judgments, cases brought by banks, for example, cases brought by trade creditors where judgments have been obtained in England and Wales. And those creditors want to enforce the judgments in the UAE, either against a corporate or against an individual who perhaps was in the UK at one point in time and then has moved over to the UAE. It's perhaps worth saying that the circular that was issued by the Ministry of Justice, on its face, it doesn't contain any restrictions. So it doesn't, for example, say that this is limited to trade creditors or this is limited to banks or anything like that.
So money that's owed in the UK can be effectively now collected here?
It can. There are still procedures that one has to go through. There are still grounds upon which enforcement potentially could be resisted. So, for instance, one of the grounds on which an enforcement could be resisted is if the English judgment falls foul of UAE public policy or public order. And you can see the sort of circumstances in which that might happen. So I think earlier you mentioned matrimonial cases, and that's a very interesting example. A very interesting question would be whether a matrimonial judgment in ancillary relief proceedings in London could be enforced here. And perhaps it can. Perhaps the UAE courts will consider the public policy exception.
Would it just affect British expats living here or anyone who's had a judgment against them in the UK courts?
It's not limited to British expats. It's open. So any English judgment, even if it's, for example, an English judgment against a Singaporean company, a Nigerian company, doesn't matter.
And how far back can this go? Is it just judgments from now, or could a financial ruling from 10, 15, 20 years ago now be chased?
Again, the circular on the face of it isn't limited in time. An interesting question is going to be what the approach of the Dubai courts will be to limitation. So certainly previous judgments can be enforced, but the question is, how far back can you go? Now, in England, if you have an English court judgment that you're trying to enforce in England itself, the limitation period for enforcement is 6 years. So it might be that the Dubai courts look to that period and say, well, if you can't enforce an English judgment in England that's older than 6 years, then why should we enforce an English judgment that's older than 6 years?
Who actually does the pursuing, and do they have to be proactive about it?
They do have to be proactive about it. The judgments will not be automatically enforced. A creditor needs to bring that judgment to the UAE and seek enforcement of it. So the UAE courts are not going to go looking for creditors. The creditors have got to come to them.
Is there a cost to pursuing it here in the UAE, do you think?
There will be costs. So there'll be costs of issuing the enforcement action. There'll be costs of instructing lawyers to pursue the enforcement action.
Could this go further than either UK judgments? Do you think, and I'm getting you to speculate a little bit here about whether this could open the door to other jurisdictions? Courts are obviously linked to each other. The UK courts will have agreements with other courts around the world. Is there kind of a knock-on effect, if you like, a secondary agreement? What's the scope?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, because there is certainly potential, and I wouldn't want to put it any higher than that at this stage, but there's potential for possibly using the English courts as a conduit jurisdiction for enforcement of judgments in the UAE. So if you have a judgment from a jurisdiction that doesn't have reciprocal enforcement with the UAE, you take that judgment to the UK courts, you enforce the judgment in the UK, you then get a UK judgment, or an English judgment, I should say, and then you bring that English judgment to the UAE and seek to enforce it over here.
Mirza Mithani, Managing Partner at Consulis Law, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Brandy.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.